everyone, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. I'm your host, Chris Denson, and in case you're just tuning in for the first time, I hope not. I mean, by this time, we've done a lot of shows, right, Maria? It's like, yeah, all like this is really close to 100 shows. I would assume you guys have heard us by now. But if not, we cover all things marketing, innovation, ideas, anything that's sort of a creative influence in business and life. So, and today we don't stop that trend. Today we're here with Ben Parr. Say hello, Ben.
Hey, hello.
Hey, I didn't see that was good. You see, you already innovated. You didn't even just say hello, which is what most people do. You said, hey, hello, which I love. So I guess for starters, just give us a little bit of a 101 on who Ben Parr is. And then I'll ask you some very nosy questions.
So Ben Parr likes scuba diving, long walks on the beach, candlelit dinners, watching Star Wars trailers. But if you mean my professional stuff, then I was the editor of Mashable, and I'm now that was years ago. Now I'm the founder of Dominate Fund, an early stage fund, but I am also the author of Captivology, The Science of Capturing People's Attention, which is on the science and psychology of attention, why we pay attention to certain people and products, and how to utilize that science to capture the attention of others.
I'm sorry, what did you say? No, that's great. Captivology. I love when my Twitter handle is Densonology, just so you know. You got another follower today. So I love ology and the idea of science and just understanding things. Give us a little bit of, what captivology is, right? Your definition. I did write down the science of psychology and attention. But is this book like a process, driven thing, or is it more like an expose on what makes it all work? Or is it a combination therein?
I mean, the book there's two parts to it. I go through the actual science of attention and the stages of it and how it works and helping people understand the links between attention and memory and the scientific research behind it. But most of it is actually focused around these seven central, what I call captivation triggers. And they're each a different chapter that talk about a different psychological trigger that captures attention, the science behind why it does, and then how you can utilize that in daily life and how you can harness that for whatever you're doing, whether you're trying to get the attention of donors for your charity, or you're a teacher trying to get the attention of students, or you're an entrepreneur trying to get the attention of customers and users.
Now, I'm curious as to why you wrote this book, right? Like, I mean, if you talk about you're a multi-hyphenate. You have an investment fund. You worked for Mashable. You're a pundit on, I think, CNET, if I'm not mistaken. And just, a lot of different multi-hyphenated experiences. Why pick this as the topic? You go like, oh, this is what people need to hear from Ben Parr about.
Well, it was because after I left Mashable, a lot of the inbound I got when I was from startups needing help on press, marketing, customer and user acquisition, virality, all these areas which, are attention. And the more that I really looked into it, the more I became fascinated. I've had lots of book offers over the years, but it was the first time when a subject came up, I just became fascinated. And to me, what attention really is the fundamental currency of the modern economy. You can't do anything anymore without the attention of somebody or something. But we don't have the public doesn't have a great understanding of attention and how it works. And so I see what I've been doing like is very important for the next 10, 20, 30 years. This research is fascinating and is very, very useful and powerful. And, I want to help a lot of people rise above the noise.
So, without reading the book on air and giving it all away, what are some of the, some of the things, principles contained within your sort of seven chapters, if you will?
I mean, that one could take like a long time, but I'll just run by the seven very, very quickly.
Sure.
Just so people understand, and I'll talk just about a few in more detail than others, but there's automaticity, which is our automatic reaction to certain colors, sights, and sounds. There's framing, which is how our frame of reference changes the way in which we pay attention. There's disruption, which is we pay attention to the things that violate our expectations. There's reward, which is the intrinsic and extrinsic motivations that capture our attention. There's reputation and the power of experts and authority figures in our lives. There's mystery and the power of mysteries and suspense on our attention. And finally, acknowledgement and why we pay attention to the people and things that pay attention to us and provide us with validation.
So format wise, right? I think you talk to a lot of celebrities. You talk to a lot of, I'll call them business celebrities. Which isn't to me, when you hear this type of conversation, you don't necessarily relate like, oh, it's based on a series of interviews, or at least it includes interviews. You would think it's just more of a sort of a play by play on the principles that you just mentioned. What was the value and going and kind of seeking counsel, if you will, or seeking insight as you were building this?
I mean, it's such a large and all-encompassing subject. And I didn't want it to come from just me. And obviously, I've had a lot of experience in the area. But I had the opportunity to, bring the best in the world into this. And I was very lucky to be able to get to interview some amazing people like Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook, Steven Soderbergh, the director, Shigeru Miyamoto, the creator of Super Mario, David Copperfield, the magician, because I wanted a view of attention not just from my experiences, just tech and media, but from across all these different industries. I interviewed everyone from PhDs to street violinists.
You left me out. I wish you could have asked me something about.
Well, now that I know.
it's great. So, one thing I was curious about, right? When you think about the idea of attention, we've had other authors on, and we've talked about these different principles. I'm always curious, especially when I read your Wikipedia page. I see that you're a dual citizen. I don't know if everything on the internet is true, but the idea of attention in other cultures, right? When you leave America, what kind of stays true and what changes?
So I thought a lot about that when I was doing this book. And the first thing is I talk about this subject a couple times, an example for automaticity and how, green is a terrible packaging color in China, for example, because it's associated with death and funerals. And in fact, there was a Revlon a few years ago. They had a perfume that performed really well in the U.S. and they brought it to South America, but that completely fell flat because the perfume was using the smell of a flower that's common in funerals in South America, the camellia flower, I believe, and it just completely died. But the book itself and the triggers, I chose them because they're fundamental across human nature. It doesn't matter which culture you come from. Something that violates our expectations is going to capture our attention and encode to memory. It's just how we're biologically wired. And so while the implementations of each is different, the fundamentals of the triggers are the same across cultures.
That's great. Yeah. It's always one of those things where you go like it is paying almost, literally paying attention to where you are and what those customs and are. Is there anything you offer in terms of like bridging the gap, right? Where I may take that idea, like if I'm going to launch my perfume in, which I do have a perfume coming, it's called Innovation Scent.
Really?
No. If you want to invest in it, sure. I'll send you a business plan. Give me a couple of weeks.
I don't want to invest in it, but it's still hilarious.
I wonder what the smell of innovation is. That would actually be a good, a good experiment. But in terms of bridging that gap, like where do you go to learn that, right? Because I think most times we find those things out by accident, right? It's like, you don't sign in red ink in certain Asian cultures, right? You don't sign your name in red. But I didn't learn that until I signed my name in red. So, is there a diligence process that needs to go? If you're, especially because you deal so much with startups and kind of like the roots of this whole project was around startup culture and, this idea of attention. But as companies begin to grow globally, wow, it's grow globally is a hard thing. Grow globally, where are the mechanisms up front that you need to sort of keep in mind as you're taking on that growth strategy?
So the research really does matter. You have to put in the time, or you got to have someone directly from that culture. Like, there is no, the thing I really realize about that is there is no shortcut to understanding the cultural differences between each country. It is actually, and I had this conversation years ago, it reminds me, I had this conversation once with Niklas Zennström. He's the founder of Skype. And the him and I had this discussion in Ireland years ago about why there's so many unicorn, like $5-10 billion businesses in the US that come out and not the same in Europe. And one of the reasons we agreed upon was that in Europe, if you launch a product, you got to adjust for 20 different cultures and 20 different languages. And the US, one culture, one language, and you have a startup that's already got to 300 million people. China comes with an even larger advantage, one language, 1 billion people. So the big thing is, like, there is a point where you do have to just do that research to figure out when you're going into new markets, but go and dominate your market first and then pick the larger markets where there's more space to do, you know, for better or for worse, there are certain advantages to certain markets if you're doing a startup.
Nice. No, that makes total sense. So, as far as, you know, applying or drinking your own Kool-Aid, I did read that you were sending the book to space, and I'm wondering what walk us through that, and then maybe some other like means by which you've applied the science in your own practice.
Don't you mean fly up to that?
Yes, fly up to that little birdie, fly. Yeah, yes, fly to it.
So, with my book, like, you know, it's really the first and most important thing is always the content. If you don't have a great product, then no one's going to care. I worked hardest on making sure it was a great product. And ever since then, it's just a matter of getting out there. I have, like, the space thing is one example of me utilizing some of my research, but it's also for a good cause, because the book's going to go into space and then it's going to parachute down. We're going to do it next weekend since this weekend the weather is bad in Atlanta. It'll come back down next weekend. We're going to raffle that off along with a chance to meet Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut, for charity. And it's going to be a fantastic time. And I have a few other plans in the works for captivating people with the book. But I'm relying in the end on word of mouth and people really being helped by the book and by its lessons.
It's great. And here's what I also wonder, right? Like, once you, and this is a lot what happens with marketers, or businesses, right? Or you hit that 300 million mark that you mentioned. What do you do once you have their attention, right? How do you keep it? Because I think getting the attention sometimes, I mean, you look at any social media feed on any given day, there's a dozen things and, you know, that I may actually pay attention to. And there may be a new site that I go to, but I never end up going back. Or I go down the rabbit hole on YouTube, and then I've never watched that video or that channel again. So how do you keep the attention once you've gotten it?
So I talk about that as well, and how there are three stages of attention. And the most important stage, the stage that no one really talks enough about, is long attention and long-term interest. And what you've got to do as a person or thing trying to capture attention is walk your audience through those three stages. And you need to use certain triggers. Like in the book, some of the triggers are kind of chronological in the sense that some are early, are immediate attention, some are short attention, and then some are long attention. And you got to utilize triggers that focus on long attention, like acknowledgement and mystery, to really captivate your audience. But the big thing is the transition. You've got to think about how you transition your audience from once you get their initial attention. Which triggers do you use to keep their attention? And I talk a lot about that.
Yeah, it's you know, and I would imagine it varies depending on your audience. And I think, you know, there's this idea, especially as time gets shorter and shorter, like, you know, 6-second videos down to, you know, 1-second video, and these micro moments. We're creating all these sort of micro moments, right, where you don't need to take in everything. There's more surface, less depth. So we have a broad swath of knowledge, but not like a deep knowledge on one particular thing. So, you know, I'm curious as to like how. I don't know, like I'll use the term millennial, but I think this is an every person thing. Like, I was trying to read an article today and I was struggling because I'm like, oh, I think I got it. You know, is there a cure for these micro moments and allowing people to actually go deep in an area?
So The first thing I want to say is that my opinion is that attention, the fundamentals of how it works, hasn't really changed because it's the same instincts as before. It's just we've adapted to a world with so much more information. Now, there are still places and content that are long form that are still very popular when you look at some of the long form pieces. And there's YouTube channels that do very well with 20, 30 minutes and losing that. But I do know what you mean, and where we're scanning more and we're not going deeper in a specific subject. And it really just kind of comes down to understanding how your own attention works and removing especially the distractions. Now, our attention is designed for novelty, which is why in the past, when there was a rustle in the bushes, we turned our heads because it could be a saber-toothed tiger to eat us or potential food source. We still have those same instincts, but we don't have saber-toothed tigers roaming the halls, thank God. But we still have those instincts, and as a result, we have to fill it in with something else. It's become smartphone notifications, emails, texts, that sort of thing. If you want to really concentrate, you've got to shut that all down. You've got to turn off those notifications. You've got to really put those things away and then start really focusing. But there's no simple answer. I think it's a thing where over time, over the next decades, our species, the human race, will better adapt towards this new information-rich economy.
Yeah, well, usually that rustling in the bushes is just me peeing. So so next time, it's okay. Don't worry about it. So when you think about – I'm looking back in your past, right, and I read Wikipedia, and it says – I'm just going to quote a little bit here. The group he created, Students Against Facebook News Feed, peaked at over 730,000 members before Facebook acquiesced to the protest and added more privacy controls. Because I think you have this history of sort of disrupting the way people view certain things or kind of exposing. I feel like that's kind of like the journalistic approach to your career thus far. But kind of at least give us some background on what exactly that particular project was at that particular moment while you were, I believe, at Columbia. I'm just curious as to like how that came to be and what it was all about.
I mean, I wouldn't call that a project as much as just a random happening.
Right.
But I was at Northwestern, actually, and this was 2006. And I woke up one morning and newsfeed appeared and existed. And you got to remember back then there was only walls and profiles. And then they added this newsfeed feature. And it was really disconcerting for a lot of people, myself included, because, you know, you would see things like, oh, this person broke up with this person. And there was no privacy controls to stop that. And I didn't like that. You'll notice nowadays you don't – like if someone breaks up, you don't see that actually typically broadcast on Facebook anymore, and there's a reason for that. Anyway, I saw that, so I created a Facebook group called Students Against Facebook Newsfeed. I handed it off to a couple friends on the internet, and I said, I'm going to go and I got to train as an RA because it was around that time I was training as a resident assistant. I left, and then a few hours later, I got a phone call, and a friend is like, dude, did you see your Facebook group? It has 10,000 members now, and this was around noon. And it was starting to spread wildly because of the newsfeed, funny enough. By the end of the first night, it had 100,000 members. And I remember sitting in front of the computer with people around me watching this happen. And basically, the next 4 or 5 days, it was my 15 minutes of fame where all these phone calls, you know, interviewed by Time and all these other publications were going – were talking to me, that sort of thing. And as a result, you know, like it was just – it was my first foray, I guess, into attention and my first foray into social media long before Mashable. Facebook and Zuckerberg eventually fixed the problem and they made some privacy features, which is what I wanted, and the story died. But, you know, I've kept in touch with Zuck ever since. Zuck reached out to me right after, kindly asking me about what things he could do to improve Facebook, which I thought was a real strong thing.
No,
I think he had a little laugh when he learned I joined Mashable. So
he was like, "Oh, I see what you did there." No, you're right. I mean, it is sort of an early foray, and how, you know, when you again, I think it's also when you think about attention, like and turning that attention into action. Being that moment is a sort of a pleasant surprise, I would imagine. There's also like an oh shit moment. Now you really have to activate. Right, it's one thing to just kind of put it out there, and like suddenly you have all this feedback and all this. You've got a bunch of troops rallying behind you, but you know what was going through your mind at that point in time when you're like, "Oh, this is actually working," and now I need to figure out my next steps.
with wait, that it was working?
Yeah, like what, exactly when you go like when you go from the 10,000 to, you know, 700.
I mean that one, like it, this is not like my plan with Mashable or anything. It was just kind of like, oh shit, that happened.
Right.
You know? Like it just kind of happened. I was a kid. I was a junior in college. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. So people were telling me, like, university like the university press department was telling me, like, here's things we'll help you set up with and all this sort of thing. It was crazy. But it just happened, honestly, by accident. There's no plan to the whole thing at all. I just, like, would wake up every day and there'd be a bunch of messages in my phone. And, you know, I had everything. Like, I had a couple thousand people message me by the end. I had, like, two people. I had one person propose to me and two people. We'll just leave it at my inbox. I had very interesting things.
I'd love to see those screenshots one day. So, you, I mean, you.
I don't know. I wonder if they still exist.
Yeah, I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg went through your inbox, you know? And was like, let me get rid of some of this evidence really quick. No, I think about when I look at some of your accomplishments, right, and you look at something like that. Like, again, we don't have to call it a project, but just like that moment over a very what felt like a narrow span of time. You look at your career at Mashable, and your journey and trajectory there was relatively quick. You were one of Forbes 30 under 30. You've kind of had this. I'm going to call it like fast tracking, or in the startup world. Rapid prototyping of your career, right? You move really fast, and even talking to you, like you don't seem like it, you seem antithetical to the types of success you've seen, personally. So I'm just curious, is like, what's your process behind being able to produce so quickly, and on multiple fronts simultaneously?
You just have to go and do. Like for me, it's been a double-edged sword in the sense that I always just, if there's something, I'm like, I'm just going to go and try this or do this. And the upside is that things get launched and some things really work. And the downside is sometimes it doesn't work and it bites you in the butt. But I've never been afraid to just put stuff out there and work as hard as I can on things. You know, Mashable was, you know, the volume and getting into the valley and just talking to as many people as I could and building that network and building that relationship. And that worked. And it's been fantastic for me over the years. I think as I've gotten a little bit older, I've kind of honed in a little bit on which things are really matter, which things don't. It was more spray and pray in the beginning. It's hard to say like how the early stages of my, like how that all happened. I also got very lucky in addition to working hard.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, it's what those two things go hand in hand, right? Luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And so, you know, you spent a lot of time just doing the work, right? You put in the 10,000 hours, and then, you know, like you said, the networking and those kinds of things begin to pay off. What's been par like in downtime? Because you do have a lot of things going on. So like,
what's down? I've heard of downtime. What is downtime?
Yeah, like everybody needs it, right? Like, you know, I manage a pretty busy team, and I'm like, hey guys, like find 2 hours at least every 2 weeks, like two consecutive hours to do nothing. Right. I think it's important to refresh. But I feel like you and I don't know. But is there a Ben Parr downtime? Like, do you hit up Burke Williams or anything like that to sort of release for a second and get your mind cleared so you can approach the next thing a little bit more aggressively or clearly?
It just depends. I'm trying a little bit more to focus on workout. And walks to just clear my mind. But Ben in his downtime, I'm just trying to do new things or just try to do fun things like scuba diving is a hobby of mine that I do if I have the chance, or just travel and catch up with friends, camping. It just kind of depends. I feel like this year with all the book stuff, I've been able to go and meet lots of amazing people, but it's also meant not a ton of downtime.
That's too bad. You gotta get some more in there. I want to, like, the scuba diving sounds great. We've got to get you some relaxation to stop you from being so successful. So with you're also on the investment side, right? Which is another interesting thing, right? I love how you've taken sort of all your knowledge and experience and kind of been able to tell one succinct story, right? I think that's what happens with a lot of multi-hyphenates. It's like, oh, well, I thought you were the investment guy, or I thought you were the, you know, the journalist. But, you know, where does when you look at the investment world, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was around this idea of like the old school napkin deal, right? Especially for the early stage startups that you deal with. Does that like how prepared should somebody be when they come to you? Like, do you ever hear an idea just in conversation, or you something gets made up on the fly and you're like, oh yeah, let's do that? Or is it more like, you know, how buttoned up do you need to be at that, you know, when they come to see Ben Parr?
Buttoned up? No. Prepared? Yes. Now, your exception is if you're like a multi-time entrepreneur that I personally know, and you're like, here's what I'm going to go do. I'm going to get excited, because the number one signal for success is, you know, a successful previous founder, honestly. But beyond that, you better have your numbers and you better be ready for a grilling, because every single time I go hard to find the holes in your business. And more than one or 100 or 1,000 entrepreneurs haven't been prepared for that, because they haven't thought through the thought process, or they haven't thought through the one sentence pitch or the market or another different aspect. I'm also trying to see how people perform under pressure, because I want to know, is this person going to be the founder CEO of 10 years from now? Because we don't invest if we don't project somebody as being that person 5-10 years down the road.
No, that's great. It's you know, I've heard a lot where it's a lot of the, it's more about the individual almost than it is about the business, because you can massage the business plan and make it certain, you can pivot and you can do all the things you need to do to create success. But you need the individual that's willing to, you know, that's able to withstand the, you know, the hurdles that you're going to incur.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely.
So when we talked to Chameleonaire a while back, we talked a little bit about this idea of a solopreneur, right? You know, the person who almost manages everything. You know, do those individuals cross your paths, and like what sorts of, and is that scalable, right? The, you know, someone who's seen a lot of success kind of on their own, and really kind of, you know, just really rocked it and has a good track record, but not necessarily a team in place, you know, or is that somebody you say, hey, let's go back to the drawing board on this one and get you a team in place?
I mean, you're your best. I mean, it's interesting because there's your best, like, founding teams, like your best companies always do have a team. There's usually one person who's kind of that face, but they're always that kind of group and team. And, you know, the best founders are team players, you know. And I've met a lot of people who are extremely successful on their own and really pushing, you know, themselves. But it's a whole different skill set when you have to lead not maybe one or two, but 50, 100, 500, 5,000, 50,000 people, you know. And it's kind of like, it's part of the reason where we're looking for these founders at scale. We're looking for, you know, early on, a founder's job, for example, is to build great products and really get in the nitty-gritty of it. But honestly, a founder's role, especially a CEO's role in later stages, is recruiting top engineers and top hires, and is being an evangelist for the company and representing the company at major events and building the top level relationships and top level sales. It's a different skill set. And if someone's not ready to, you know, take up or learn or have that skill set innately, then they're going to fail.
What's been the hardest lesson you've had to learn along the way?
Controlling my ego. And it's still a lesson I continually learn. I mean, I was at age 24, I was given the power as co-editor of Mashable, and everyone wanted to talk to me. I wasn't ready for that. And it got to me sometimes, but being able to understand the, you know, there's lots of luck involved and there's lots of amazing people involved, and it's never just about you, no matter what it is an important lesson to learn. And I'm lucky I learned it early, but I'm still not, you know, I'm always constantly trying to be more vigilant about that sort of thing. It's a hard lesson to learn for a lot of people, especially if you receive and feel success early.
Yeah. And I mean, even as a leader, right? Like, and then, you know, you have this idea of trickle down behavior, right? And so if you're leading an organization and your style is going to be reflected in some of the output, you know, what sort of philosophies have you adopted over the years? You know, since ego stepped in, or like just moved over to the side a little bit, you know, what are some of those things that are your go-to for just being a good leader and a good example for these successes?
So I remember actually I did an interview with CNN, and I told them what my grandfather told me, which was his like four pieces of life advice. And to me, I always take action to like improve myself. And I have a list of usually my flaws that I put up so that I can remind myself what they are and how I can improve upon them and my goals and what I want to do. But, you know, my grandfather's advice, and there's five actually, it was do what you say, finish what you start, be on time, say please and thank you, and opportunities can seldom be hoarded. And I believe if I can just do that, then I'll be in all right shape. And most people will be in good shape. You just got to deliver on your promises and know that great opportunities are not just about you.
Yeah. The kudos to your grandfather. I mean, I love how previous generations are so simple, right? And those are the things that we forget. It's kind of like I have two kids, and one quote I keep in mind all the time is like, sometimes we try so hard to give our kids what we didn't have that we forget to give them what we did. And it's, you know, there's these like very simple, you know, those are the rules you learn with, you know, at the age of five, right? In books and in school, and they apply to the daily grind of business and entrepreneurship and innovation and technology. So that's awesome that you're able to harness that and use it. What motivates you? You know, when I look at people who are successful multi-hyphenates, there's always, you know, an internal drive to succeed and complete and do all the things that your grandfather mentioned. So where's that internal motivation? What is the kind of like the key driver for you?
Well, so there could be a couple different answers, but when I was in college, I kind of decided, and I don't know always how it came to this, but I decided I had one purpose in life, and it was, and it's very corny, that I had the ability and thus the responsibility to change the world for the better. And what it really means is that my life is about the more I do, the more the better I can potentially make the world. And I'm motivated by making sure that I'm doing what I'm meant to do. Which just sounds odd, but more like if I'm not living to the fullest of my potential and doing as much as I can, then I'm leaving change off the table. I'm leaving opportunities off the table. And it's that fear of that maybe drives me in some way. It's a hard one. I sometimes don't think about it enough.
Yeah, no, it is, you know, I think passion is one thing, right? But then when you add a layer of purpose to it, you know, it's like when we talk to Adam Garone, who's the CEO of Movember, you know, he said he got to a point in life where he wanted to move from success to significance. And I think once you hit that pivot, you know, it, like the world really opens up. Right. Whereas it's not about achieving. It's about doing something that makes a difference. And there's a difference there as well.
Absolutely.
So one piece of advice when I watched one of your news clips, and we talked, you talked about leading with credentials, right? As far as going back to the, you know, the idea of captivology. And what is some of the science right around that? You know, as an interviewer, a lot of times, you know, I've done talks about like evolution through conversation, right? And I'm like, Kanye yourself, right? But there's a difference between Kanye yourself and really celebrating your abilities and your capabilities versus, you know, as you kind of put it, was kind of subtly and matter-of-factly leading with your successes.
It's the matter-of-factly part. It's not being afraid to state the fact. Maybe you are an expert in the area, but explain why. You know, I studied, you know, 18 different, you know, at 18 different universities, or I have a PhD in this subject, and not being afraid to assert that, but at the same time, not letting it become name dropping and not letting it become, you know, I'm the best. It's not about that. It's about establishing in a room you're an expert, because we pay attention to experts almost over almost anything else. It really, really matters whether or not you establish yourself as an expert in that expertise.
No, it's I mean, it's great. It's so funny how and well, what I was going to ask is how do you know the difference, right? Some people feel like there's certain people where they talk and they come off as, you know, a little bit more on the ego braggadocious side versus being matter of fact. So what are there any sort of indicators, or is it just being a good listener and like watching people's reactions and seeing how they respond to your brain dump of accomplishments?
Well, it's not about the brain dump. It's just about, you know, you don't even sometimes have to say it. Sometimes it's just in the bios, or people already know it. If people already know it, then you don't have to say it. And then a lot of times it's really just, you know, showing that you care is more listening than talking, is more providing a sounding board than trying to list the things and the people you've met and the list of accomplishments you've had.
Right. Makes total sense. So the show is called Innovation Crush. I'm curious, when you think about, you know, all the things that you get to see on a day-to-day basis and all the people you get to touch, what are you crushing on out there? What's your innovation crush currently? Is there something you see out in the world you're like, oh my gosh, that's amazing, I wish I had been a part of that, or I love what they did there?
I think about that all the time. Now, I mean, what, for example, Dominate Fund, we really like to invest in what we call the next generation of platforms. And so there's a couple of different ones that we've invested in that I just find fascinating, like wireless electricity. We invest in a company called Ubeam, which is creating what is going to be Wi-Fi for power, the power of like augmented reality and virtual reality, or some of the new biotech stuff that's happening. I was at a bio accelerator yesterday, and I got to see some really cutting edge biological technology. For me, there's just a whole bunch of different areas. It's just who's building the great platforms in each of these areas. There's just more and more to be excited about right now.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, you go to CES or South by Southwest, and the combination of those two, it's like, I have no idea which one is sort of the breakout thing. I'm excited about it all, and I'm lucky enough that I'm in a position where I get to, you know, try to leverage a lot of the cool things I see out there. Last but not least, before we wrap up, complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is...
Ooh, that's a good one.
Thank you.
That's not my answer. innovation to me is positive change, is positive hope, is changing something that exists fundamentally for the better and the betterment of the humanity and our planet and our world. That's what real innovation is. And it's not just technology, but it's social order, it's socioeconomic, it's political, it's biological, it's social, it's all these areas. But yeah, it's about that positive change and fundamental positive change.
No, I think you totally hit the nail on the head. You know, it's one of those things that gets, you know, gets my goose, is, you know, this idea of like innovation being sort of an agnostic experience, right? It's not tied to one specific, like a lot of times we associate it to technology and robots. Like that's kind of where I think the average citizen kind of goes when they think about the word. But I think everyone wants to innovate, no matter if you're like a family man and you're at home and trying to figure out like, how are we going to reroute our kids' activities, or, you know, like you mentioned, like world changing.
I have to disagree with you a little bit.
Uh-oh.
On this one.
All right.
I don't think most people want to innovate. I think it takes a motivated set to actually want to and be active in innovating. And I come from small town Illinois, and I know lots of people who are very happy, and there's nothing wrong with it. Very happy though with routine and being able to wake up in the morning and go to work and come to work, get back from work by 5:30 and be with their families and repeat process. And they're not thinking about how do I improve the world or how do I innovate in this or that area. They don't. That's not a thing I think a lot of people actually want. I think it's a subset of really dedicated, motivated people. And the difference is that you and I are surrounded by these people all the time. But when you go outside of that bubble, innovation is not a thing that a lot that some people actually are looking for, aspiring for. It's why when you see changes on Facebook and others, people backlash because a lot of people do not like change.
That's true. And well, there's a theory also, like, you know, it's not that people don't like change, they don't like transition, right? And when I think about the number of, I'll call them non-innovation professionals, if you will, you know, that will come to me for advice on a life moment, or, you know, so even that guy who has the routine on a day-to-day basis is still like, there's this one thing I'm trying to figure out, right? And it could be very surface, like, you know, mounting a TV on the wall and which TV should they get, or, you know, or something a little bit more deep, like, you know, my wife's sick and I need to figure out X, Y, and Z. I think I look at it in terms of creative problem solving. Right. And I think we all encounter different problems on a day-to-day basis, and those need, you know, new solutions, right? You know, you do the same thing, you get the same results, and literally, or if you're facing a new problem, you know, then how do you use that as an opportunity to grow and do something new and different? But that was just my take on it. But I 100%, like, I know that they're, like, I too come from Detroit in the Midwest, and it's like, you know, you go home and you visit people and you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, it's slow and steady. It's good. And I feel like a lot of times as kind of going back to what what we were talking about before, it's like this idea of simplicity and figuring out how to maintain, you know, this a place in life that you've achieved. So where can people find you? I know you have close to 65,000 Twitter followers, so a lot, at least that many people found you. So, but as far as, like, where can people reach Ben Parr and find out more about you? Where do they go?
Well, you find a rocket and you take it up to about 150 kilometers up in space, and then you'll find me on. Well, maybe this is 50 years from now. If you want to find me and you want to see my work and you want to talk to me about my book or anything, I'm at Ben Parr on every social network: Facebook.com/Ben Parr, at Ben Parr on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Shots, Quora, you name it, it's at Ben Parr. And if you're interested in captivology, captivology.com. It's on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble. It's everywhere. You can also follow it at Captivology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And I am not hard to find.
Awesome. And what's your home address?
It's space. I already gave it to you. It's 50 miles up.
My home address is space. Is there area code and zip code in space? So, everybody, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush. Thank you, Ben Parr, for joining us, man. This was awesome.
Thank you for having me.
And we will talk to you guys next time. Thank you.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schleichinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.